Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Churchill Forge versus Joanne Hamilton Brown.
May it please the court, Mr. David Fritchie will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court, the opinion of the Third Court of Appeals in this case eviscerates the contractual right of a landlord, this landlord, Churchill Forge, to reimbursement for damages under a contract with a tenant. More importantly, and what is very critical to this case, it subjects any owner of more than two units, two rental dwellings in Texas, to damages of $2,000 plus 1 month's rent if there is a reimbursement provision in a lease.
Why can't they sue for negligence? If someone causes a fire in an apartment building and causes property damage, the property code provides that the common law remedies to recover for property damage, that is available, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
And there's nothing in the code that would preclude such an apartment house owner from pursuing that remedy at common law.
There is nothing. In fact, it was pursued at the time of the trial court level. And it was dropped.
I understand, but your statement then that we're going to wipe out any ability for apartment owners to be able to be protected in this circumstance is a little bit of an overstatement, given the fact that we do have a negligence cause of action at common law that's been preserved in the property code.
There is the negligence cause of action, but more importantly, Justice Hankinson, mm-hmm. 9205.63 of the property code specifically provides that a person who has more than two dwelling units who relies on 92.006E or attempts to, could be liable for $2,000 in damages plus 1 month's rent.
No, I understand your argument of the statute, but I'm just saying that we have all these the sky is falling positions in the briefs, and you've kind of started with the sky is falling argument, which makes it sound like that the property code would provide what you just stated as the exclusive remedy for an owner of a rental property, and that is not, and I just want to confirm with you that I'm not missing something along the way, that in fact there really is a remedy under Texas law if a tenant negligently causes a fire that in fact destroys the apartment complex.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why was negligence not pursued here?
That was dropped at the trial court level.
Why?
And I do not know, Your Honor. I was not in this case at the trial court level. It was pursued on the breach of contract ground. And proceeded on the breach of contract ground under the reimbursement provision
was
of the
TAA.
Was
there a limitations problem?
I'm sorry?
Was there a limitations problem?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. But I believe that they specifically relied on the contractual provision because it is very distinct and very clear. 92.006 and
Let me confirm something else. There's no allegation that the respondent in this case was the person who caused the fire or was negligent in any way.
No.
And in fact, it was her son, I believe, who was the actual tenant who was alleged to have been negligent.
Your Honor, she was a tenant and the son
was
a tenant.
I understand, but she didn't live in the property. Is that right?
She did not reside there.
But the underlying factual allegation is that she had nothing to do with causing the fire.
That is correct.
And in fact, it was the son. So there really is no negligence cause of action against her.
Correct.
So the only way to recover from her is under your contract argument.
Yes, Your Honor. She was a tenant, and under 92.001 of the property code, a tenant is defined as someone who has...
What's the specific issue in this case on why she is or isn't liable under the lease?
She should be liable, Your Honor.
And why? Because this condition is not covered by subdivision B?
She is liable because of the reimbursement provision in paragraph 12 of the TAA lease. It specifically states that contractually this person who is a tenant, a signatory under the lease, she was not a guarantor, she was not in the occupant provision, she was a signatory to the lease and a person who had the exclusive right to possession. That made her subject to all of the provisions of Section 92 of the Property Code as a defined tenant. This reimbursement provision is very specific, and it continues, the TAA lease continues to have paragraph 29 that says each resident is jointly and severally liable for all lease contract obligations. She was legally a resident. She had the absolute right to exclusive possession of this unit at any time.
Okay, Mr. Fritsch, let's go back. You have said that you have a negligence cause of action for burning down this apartment complex, but I'm trying to, for the Court of Appeals to have concluded what it concluded in this case, it had to have concluded that this provision under the property code was tantamount, the provision that contract was an attempt to waive the provisions of the code that says the tenant cannot be liable for the damages affecting health. If the Court of Appeals' interpretation of the statute is correct, it seems to me what it argues against, or what it is actually saying, is that the landlord would not have a tort claim against the tenant, because all that happens here is the notion that the landlord can't assert that the tenant must pay for conditions of the property that affect health and safety. And that's all they're saying. And if they say that this contract, which requires the tenant to pay for the damages it negligently causes, is an attempted waiver of the landlord's obligation to make these repairs, it seems to me that might ultimately affect even whether or not a tort claim can be brought against the tenant.
It could, Your Honor, and if I could expand on the third court's confusion. The third court basically misread this provision of C and rewrote it to say a landlord's duties and remedies cannot be waived except by E. What's critical, and as Justice Heck pointed out in Timberwalk, 9261 is not a model of clarity. This entire habitability statute was not necessarily a model of clarity at the time it was enacted by the legislature. But what's critical throughout the habitability statute is that we're talking about a landlord's duty to repair, not a landlord's remedy against the tenant. It is the landlord's duty to repair and a tenant's remedy under subchapter B, which covers conditions materially affecting the physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant, which can be waived by E. E, which is what the Third Court of Appeals turned on, E specifically says that any condition covered by subchapter B can only be waived if the landlord first owns only one dwelling unit. Well, every landlord that owns more than one dwelling unit, whether it's a multifamily property owner or whether it's an individual who owns more than one unit, could never comply with E. So what E does, and what the Third Court of Appeals did, is they misread a statutory requirement to obtain a waiver of a duty as a statutory requirement for the waiver of a landlord's remedy.
But the landlord's remedies are contained elsewhere in the property code. Correct? If a tenant is not taking care of property the way the tenant is supposed to, various other kinds of things, there are other provisions of the lease, and there are provisions of the property code that, for example, would allow the landlord to terminate the lease, to remove the tenant from the property. The point is that the landlord does have remedies elsewhere in the property code.
In the
lease with respect to taking care of the property. Isn't that correct, or am I missing something?
If I'm
in your apartment and you find out that I'm busy knocking holes in the wall, can't you terminate the lease and remove me from the property?
I can give you a notice to vacate for a non-rent breach of the lease and remove you from the property.
Okay, exactly. And then on top of it, the other thing that the property code provides is that you have my security deposit.
Correct.
And you are able, there are provisions in the property code I have secured that I'm going to return the property to you in the shape in which I got it from you, basically, subject to normal wear and tear. And so you then have, the landlord then has a remedy, the use of the security deposit to be made whole in those circumstances.
That's correct, but if the security deposit is only $500 and the damages in this case were $772,000, the landlord really doesn't have the remedy, because what the third court did is they said that this reimbursement provision could not be utilized because it's a waiver under 92006E.
But I'm just trying to understand how the property code works. And you have focused on the fact that C says a landlord's duties and a tenant's remedies. And that's what this provision, this particular set of provisions in the property code are designed to go to. But there are other provisions of the property code and that are then included in leases that go towards the landlord's remedies when a tenant doesn't do what the tenant is supposed to do. And I'm just saying this doesn't cover the waterfront here, does it?
It affects the 1.4 million leases that are in existence, the TAA leases.
I understand that, but I guess I'm not making myself clear, so I'm just trying to understand how this fits in the greater scheme of things.
Your Honor, the property code specifically provides that the landlord and the tenant may contract for shifting of risks, as each contract does.
But what I'm concerned, what I'm focusing on is there is some place to go in the property code to look for the landlord's remedies.
If there is, Your Honor, under this opinion that was issued by the third court, I don't see it.
No. I'm asking you just on your part, just in terms of the property code. Then how is the landlord able to go in and evict a tenant if they're in fact not paying rent or not taking care of the property or whatever?
They have the absolute right to bring a forcible detainer proceeding under 24.005.
Okay. That's my question. Is that there aren't there other provisions elsewhere in Texas law that give landlords remedies against irresponsible tenants who aren't doing what they're supposed to do?
24.005 specifically allows the landlord to do that. However, it also restricts the landlord from only receiving rent in an eviction proceeding. They can't sue for other damages if they're going to evict under 24.005.
But this statute would say that you could not evict the tenant if you had a condition affecting the health and safety that the landlord had not prepared. Isn't that the tenant's protection under this statute?
The tenant's protection is to force a landlord under this statute, and as this court pointed out in Timberwalk, the critical issue here was how does the tenant require the landlord to repair a condition that materially affects the health or safety of the ordinary tenant. That is the only area that subchapter B goes to. And that's why the reversal of the Court of Appeals is so critical, because they read this not as a waiver of a landlord's remedy, as Justice Hankinson is getting to. They did argue that it is the waiver of a landlord's remedy as opposed to the waiver of a landlord's duties and the tenant's remedies. They basically rewrote 92.006.
Now, let me go to the specific language, if you would, and tell us why condition covered by subchapter B does not include casualty losses, since casualty losses, as well as conditions caused by the tenant, are all part of chapter 92, subpart chapter 92.
The most critical point is that if the tenant causes the damage, and unless it was caused by normal wear and tear, the landlord does not ever have a duty under subchapter B to repair that condition.
Okay, but you've underlined over here for us condition covered by subchapter B, which seems to be the language that everything turns on, and the Court of Appeals looked at, it seems. And so I'm real interested in your position about attaching the plain meaning to that language, and what does that language in specific mean? How do we determine it?
Your Honor, the plain meaning begins in 92.006, which refers to conditions materially affecting the physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant. The tenant's obligation or the tenant's right then devolves under 92052A, where the tenant has the right to require the landlord to meet its duty by giving notice. The tenant is not delinquent at the time the notice is given, and the condition that they are giving the notice regarding materially affects the physical health or safety of an ordinary tenant.
Okay, now your opponent's going to tell us, I think, that condition covered by subchapter B, if it means conditions materially affecting the physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant, is going to include fires that burn down apartment complexes.
Subchapter
B. Response?
Subchapter B addresses casualty losses in 92054. All subchapter B in 92054 addresses with regard to casualty losses is the right for either party to terminate the lease. And then when you go back to 92061, 92061 is, as this court said in Timberwalk, specifically outlines only and refers to the duties of a landlord and the remedies of a tenant. It does not change or alter any law under contract, statutory law, or common law that is otherwise consistent with subchapter B. 90?
But in 054, either the landlord or the tenant can terminate if it's a complete loss. So
casualty loss, yes.
The exception is if the tenant caused it.
Correct.
So that defines duties and remedies. It actually defines remedies in both sides of that.
A remedy regarding the termination of the lease, the right to reside there.
And so all that's all that covers is here's the remedy if, regardless of who did it first, either side can terminate. But if the tenant did it, they can't terminate, but the landlord can. Is that
correct?
Right? Then the second part, if it's partially destroyed, then same rights, but if the tenant caused it, the tenant doesn't have a right.
That's correct.
So that adjusts remedies only. What I'm not clear on is how do you get to the point that just because under one of those sections, B, 052B, the landlord doesn't have a duty if the condition was caused by the tenant, that somehow also limits or puts something on the tenant? How does that section, just because it says the landlord doesn't have a duty, go the other way and imply a duty on the tenant?
Your Honor,
contractually or statutorily at this point?
Your Honor, if it doesn't, the result would be absurd because you would have no one liable.
But they know how to do the thing because they showed us they could do that in 054 because they say if it's caused by the tenant, then the tenant doesn't have the remedy.
That really, I believe 92054 really only goes to the right to possession of the property, whether you're going to occupy
it. That's my point. It doesn't affect the issue that we have here.
That's correct.
They're saying the key is whether this situation is one covered by subchapter B. And if it is, then 9206E applies, and we see what the consequences are by applying E. And their view is, when you get there and you apply E, your landlord can't meet that requirement, so they can't contract the way they did. Is that true?
That's true, Your Honor, but it's only as to the landlord's duty to repair and the tenant's remedy if the landlord doesn't repair. It is not anything beyond that. In 92061 specifically says that notwithstanding what is in subchapter B, there is no waiver of the landlord's contractual or other statutory rights, including the right to contract for the right of reimbursement.
But let me ask you just real quick. If we read condition covered by subchapter B to include casualty loss, wouldn't it make some sense that the legislature made a policy choice that they weren't going to allow a casualty loss to be put on a tenant unless these conditions were met?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the only way any landlord can meet 92006E is if they only own one rental.
My point exactly, that they don't want to shift the burden of casualty loss for an entire apartment complex to an individual tenant unless it's a single unit that the landlord owns, and in which event there may be different policy choices for shifting a casualty loss.
Well, Your Honor, you have to ask the question then, what if a tenant knocks a hole in the wall and that is a condition that materially affects the health or safety of an ordinary tenant? Well, if the same argument would apply, if the landlord can't bring an action against the tenant for the destruction of the entire building, they can't bring one against the tenant, bring an action against the tenant for a hole in the wall that the tenant caused or that the tenant's friend caused.
Sure they can, for negligence.
They could, but not under the reimbursement provision under this contract. But the act may not have been negligent, Your Honor. That there may have been a child playing.
But that would not be a casualty loss, would it?
That would not be a casualty
loss.
Well,
that's my point. I mean, again, my original question.
When you look at 92054, however, casualty losses as addressed in 92054 only address who has the right to terminate the lease.
I understand that, but again, the question is, if casualty loss is a condition covered, why wouldn't this be a legislative policy choice to put that burden on the landlord to acquire insurance for casualty loss that it takes into account in charging rent and not be able to pass that on to the tenant in the multi-unit complex?
Your Honor, I think you have to go back to this court's decision in Timberwalk and what the court said with regard to the reason that subchapter B was originally enacted. It was created to establish a scheme and a system for a landlord to be held to minimum standards of habitability. That was all that subchapter B was enacted to do. And the enactment of subchapter B created the right of a tenant to force a landlord who was lax in his or her duties to repair a condition that materially affected their health or safety by giving them notice, by not being delinquent in rent when they gave notice, and if that condition in fact materially affected the physical health or safety.
As I understand your position, 92.006E allows the landlord to shift that right of repair, take that right of repair away from the tenant. That's all the statute is designed to do if they only own one apartment complex.
What 92.006E does, it creates a situation most likely where there is an unsophisticated landlord and perhaps an unsophisticated tenant. It creates a statutory scheme for, in this one circumstance, the landlord to shift.
It negates the duty to repair in 92.052A.
Correct. And Justice Owen, that's the key thing, the duty to repair versus a remedy.
But that's your position. That's
yes.
That's your position on what the purpose of 92.006E
yes.
is. It's to negate the duty to repair under 92.05A.
Yes.
Up to it.
Yes.
Going back to Justice O'Neill's question about a policy consideration, conceivably, why would the legislature have had such very, very specific requirements with in terms of repairing things, as you say this provision does, but not in any way cover the circumstance to protect a tenant from a huge casualty loss, such as the burning down of an entire, no requirement with respect to what the lease needs to do if you read this provision as restrictively as you would have it be read. And we've got the legislature being very, very concerned about saying, gosh, we want to make sure that tenants know what they're getting into. It has to be conspicuous and it has to be all kinds of other things. And that's for just repairing the hole in the wall. But it doesn't really matter if there's a shifting and in this instance, it's not the negligent tenant who's trying to be held responsible. Well, we can just put anywhere in the small print in the lease that you can be responsible for burning down a whole apartment complex even though you weren't negligent. What's the policy choice behind that kind of interpretation or drafting of a statute? I don't understand that.
I think you have to go back to the basis and the reason the legislature enacted the habitability statute, and it was in response to this court's decision in Cameron to create the minimum standards of habitability only, not to create some broad duty on the part of the landlord to repair any condition that the tenant causes negligently or that a tenant's friend causes negligently.
Is a fire that burns down an apartment complex a condition covered by subchapter B?
Only if it materially affects the health or safety of an ordinary tenant, and the tenant is using the statute, subchapter B, in an attempt to require the landlord to meet his or her duty to repair the condition. Otherwise, it is not.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Martin.
May it please the Court, Mr. Archie.
May it please the Court. Petitioner in their brief presents the issue on appeal as being the following. Can a landlord who owns multiple rental dwellings contractually obligate a tenant to pay for damages caused by a co-tenant in the same dwelling? The answer to that question is yes, but only for the conditions enumerated in 92006F, which concerns damages for wastewater stoppage to doors, windows, and screens, and from leaving doors and windows open. And
let's say that you're an apartment owner and you rent to two college students.
Yes.
And they pile the furniture up in the middle of the floor and light a fire and burn it all up and burn up the walls, burn up all the drapes, burn up the carpet. You have no remedy against them?
You definitely have a remedy against them. You have the common law remedy of negligence or intentional action on the part of those two tenants.
What if you, as a landlord, had required their parents to sign the lease and say, look, I don't rent to college students at all unless the parents agree to be liable under this reimbursement clause. So I want you to understand, if your children tear up this apartment, you're going to be liable. Now, you're saying the statute doesn't permit landlords to do that?
The statute will not permit a landlord, unless the landlord has one dwelling or less, and then only if it meets the fair notice requirements of 92006E.
No. If you can't, you would have no recourse against the parents, even though you required them to sign the lease and required them to reimburse in case there was a...
Exactly. Absent a common law right, you would have no recourse against a non-negligent tenant because of the clear, specific, and unambiguous language of 92006E.
Okay, let me add, you said that several times. Point to the language in 92.006E that says that a landlord cannot contract with a tenant for the tenant to be liable for the tenant's own negligence.
It doesn't say that.
Okay, so what about any language in any of those provisions that says that a landlord cannot contract with a tenant for the tenant to be liable for the damages the tenant causes by the tenant's negligence?
That's not the facts of this case, and the statute, I don't believe, says that. We're talking about a non-negligent tenant.
No, let's talk about the facts of this case.
Okay, non-negligent tenant.
So your argument is that
even though it's to a negligent tenant, if this answers your question, the statute would not allow a landlord to use an agreement as the basis for recovery against a negligent tenant unless they can fit themselves within the requirements of 92006E, but that does not mean the landlord is without a remedy.
So what provision says that a tenant that a landlord cannot require a tenant to pay for damages caused to an apartment by the tenant's co-tenant?
The language in 92006E, which does that in its entirety, first of all, the 92006E, we're talking about residential apartment or residential leases only, and a landlord and a tenant may agree that the tenant has to pay for repairs covered by subchapter B,
which is a condition,
conditions are met.
Which is a condition materially affecting the physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant that was not caused by the tenant, or a lawful occupant of the tenant's dwelling, or a member of the tenant's family.
Not correct.
Okay.
A condition of subchapter B can be caused by the tenant. It can be caused by the landlord. It can be of unknown cause. It can be an act of God.
But
there's no limitation as to the source of what a condition subchapter B is.
Except the waiver language in C only applies to a landlord cannot get the tenant to waive a duty of the landlord. Isn't that what it says? C says a landlord's duty cannot be waived except as to subsection E. And doesn't the duty of a landlord It's the duty of the landlord referred to in C is predicated on a condition not caused by the tenant, and that duty cannot be waived by the tenant.
I think the confusion, at least I'm having, if I understand Your Honor's question, is that 92006E does not create an additional duty on the landlord. It does not create an additional duty on the landlord. All it says is if you're going to shift the risk
of a duty that the landlord has.
The landlord, in our case, Your Honor, has no duty to repair the premises.
Right. And C says that C is a provision about an attempt to waive a duty. What language says that the landlord cannot contract with a tenant to pay for damages caused by the tenant or a lawful occupant of the tenant's dwelling or a member of the tenant's family? What provision there says that the landlord cannot contract with the tenant to reimburse it for those damages?
The landlord can, as long as it has one dwelling or less and meets the fair notice requirements. Landlord can't.
But E only applies if the landlord attempts to waive its duty to make a repair. But B says it doesn't have that duty.
No, that's not what E does. The landlord's not attempting to waive his duty to repair. In our fact situation, the landlord has no duty to repair. We have a total casualty loss. Yes, Your Honor.
Is E independent of C? In your view, E could just sit there on its own.
And I don't see why it can't stand on its own, Your Honor.
And if you're not allowed to make a deal, if the landlord and tenant are trying to make a contract that's not within E or not within something else in the property code, in Chapter 92, then they can't make the deal? Is that the way you read it?
If I understand the
universe
of question.
Deals between a landlord and tenant are contained somewhere in here.
If the deal, of course, is limited to a residential landlord-tenant dwelling setting, and if the deal has to do with getting the tenant to pay for a condition covered by subchapter B, only through the agreement, yes, I assert it stands on its own.
So somewhere in Chapter 92 is everything about a landlord can charge rent.
That's right.
And E has to be read independently of C.
I don't know that it has to be read independently to C. To come back to your concern, Your Honor, again.
Let me put it another way. Do you have to engraft C into E to be able to interpret E? If I understand the argument that your opponent's making, he's saying we need to look at C in order to be able to interpret E. And I think that's the source of the questioning, if I'm understanding correctly. Do you have to do that?
I don't think you have to do that. I think what my opponent is attempting to do is take a clear, specific, and arguably, in my position, a very unambiguous statute, and engraft onto it language that says, well, E does not apply if the damage is caused by the tenant, the tenant's guest, etc. That language is not there. There's nothing to make E inapplicable.
What's your response to his argument? He's asking us, I think what he's saying is you've got to look at all these provisions together and how they work together in order to understand what E means.
And they do work.
And would you respond to that argument? I understand you must be saying something different.
Well, I think they all do work together. If you understand that all E does is limit a landlord's ability through an agreement to shift the risk to a loss that's covered to a tenant. That's all E does.
Isn't that a little bit broader than what E really does?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
You said that the scope of what E does to limit the ability
of a landlord
to shift the risk of loss. And that, I think, is overreading what subchapter B does. Subchapter B is focused on ensuring the habitability of a tenancy. And basically what E is focused on is limiting the landlord's ability to shift to the tenant the responsibility for habitability.
if I understand the court statement, that may be correct. I think also Chapter B does, for our purposes in E, is define the conditions that are covered.
Define the conditions.
And those conditions are what materially affect an ordinary tenant, health and safety.
Well,
if you have that kind of damage and you want the tenant to pay for it, you got to come within the contract.
No, it's not talking about that kind of damage. The whole focus, it seems to me, of 92.06E is to limit. Well, going back to the big scheme of things, the big scheme of things is before we had the statutory scheme, there were certain common law burdens put upon the landlord to ensure the habitability of the tenancy.
Correct. I agree.
And that the purpose of part of these provisions is to ensure that the landlord, by statute, will continue to be responsible for the habitability of the tenancy.
Creates duties to repair.
And the purpose of this is to ensure that landlords will not be onerous with their tenants by shifting to the tenant the responsibility of ensuring the habitability of the tenancy.
Certainly.
Unless you just own one unit.
Unless you just own one unit.
Tell the tenant, look, habitable or unhabitable, that's your problem.
That's right.
So why doesn't all E do is stand for the very unremarkable proposition that if you're a commercial landlord in Texas, you have to keep the property habitable, and if you're not, you don't.
And you better insure your casualty losses, because you're the best person in a position to know your risk and protect yourself against those risks, and don't expect a non-negligent tenant.
Well, can a tenant...
But it wouldn't make any difference whether you're negligent or not.
Well, they still have a cause of action if they're negligent. It's just that they were limited by use of an agreement to shift it in an agreement.
Why does that make any sense?
To protect a non-negligent tenant and to engraft upon a statute what is known as the fair notice doctrine that's present in common law, because they recognize the disparity of bargaining between a commercial landlord and a tenant, and who's better able to assess this risk and protect themselves from the risk. How can even a tenant protect themselves?
Well, I was going to say, does a tenant have an insurable interest in anything beyond its own unit in a multi-unit dwelling?
I would argue probably not, unless you argue that this reimbursement clause creates the insurable interest.
Did Ms. Brown not have insurance here?
Homeowner's insurance. Her own personal homeowner's insurance.
But you can get liability insurance. You can get an umbrella to cover personal liability.
Homeowner's insurance, and I would argue that the umbrella for it would not cover contractual obligations.
Did her insurance pay for this?
She is being defended under a reservation of rights letter, and they're saying they're not going to pay for it because it's a contractual obligation not covered by a Texas homeowner.
Mr. policy. Pierce, I'm still having, as best I can tell, you say the subparagraph E stands independent of C. Even if we read all of these together, E could stand alone. E stands for the proposition that a landlord may not contract with a tenant for the tenant to be liable for the tenant's own negligence or the negligence of the tenant's family member. You're saying a non-negligent tenant, but the contracting for a family member's or another co-tenant's negligence on the property. You're saying E prohibits a landlord from making that kind of contract.
Yes.
Right. Now, what does subpart C do with respect to E? C says that landlord, for a condition not caused by the tenant, has an obligation to repair. Is that what C is doing? It's saying that the landlord has an obligation to repair, and that obligation to repair can't be waived unless they follow the conditions of E.
Are the other provisions, D, F, D, D, E, or F?
Well, we're talking about E,
D, right
here. And so E accomplishes two purposes. One is it not only gives the mechanism by which a landlord shifts away its duty to repair a condition not caused by the negligence of a tenant, but E also standing alone is tantamount to a public policy determination by the legislature that a landlord cannot contract with a tenant for the tenant to reimburse it for property damage caused by the tenant's negligence.
I can't think of any reason why that is not
contractable. Now, where do you get the definition? What is the what's a condition covered by subchapter B? Where is
it's
where
in
is it
it's in 92006C and 92052 talk about a condition means the state of property that materially affects the health and safety of an ordinary tenant. And 92054 specifically says a casualty loss from fire or smoke that makes the premises totally or partially unusable is a such a condition.
Okay, so C, it's important that C be considered in determining what a condition covered by subchapter B is.
It also defines that condition. It's not the only place in Chapter 92
so
where
E
we can
look
for that.
So E has to be read in connection, at least in part, with C in order to find out what this condition is.
I don't, well, I've cited other provisions besides C that also define that condition in subchapter B.
But D, E, and F are just exceptions to C. They just C says you can't do this
right.
Except as provided in D, E, and F.
Correct.
What can't you do? A landlord's duties may not be waived, and a tenant's remedies cannot be waived. Where does C say that a landlord's right to make a tenant pay for the damage the tenant causes cannot be waived?
Well, C, in referencing E, in effect, does that because, if I understand the court's question, abrogates by implication the common law remedy of a contract cause of action because there's a clear repugnance.
He's just an exception, C.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
E is just, by the terms of C, E is just an exception.
Correct. And a landlord may have a duty to repair. But E does not, if I understand, E is not creating an additional duty, especially in our fact situation. The landlord could take the casualty loss money, invest it in stocks, and walk away, and our tenant does not have a right to require him to repair the premises or terminate the lease or require
which
reduction in rent.
Which is not a very surprising thing that a person who burns down an apartment can't make the landlord build it back. That's not very surprising.
My client did not burn down the apartment building. That's an important distinction in this case.
A tenant burned it down.
A tenant burned it down. And if my client, if they have a cause of action against my client outside an agreement that does not meet E, they can go after my client. There is no such cause of action.
Looking at condition covered by subchapter B, I just want to clarify what you said earlier, that language in E, if it means conditions materially affecting the physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant because of the totality of the provisions, it means those kinds of conditions, I think you said, caused by the tenant, caused by the landlord, caused by an act of God, or caused
wherever.
By who knows what.
They're not, the source of them are not limited.
And in fact, Chapter 92 deals with all those various scenarios.
It certainly does.
It's not limited to just those that the landlord may cause or be responsible for.
That's correct, or what the tenant may cause and be responsible for.
Now, is the condition in subparagraph B of 9252 the same condition that's covered in E?
Yes. If it has to be a condition that materially affects the health and safety. You could, outside of E, if you have a bad paint job and you have a condition and you want to move, you don't have a duty to repair it and you want to move it to the tenant, I guess you could do it because it's not a condition that materially affects the safety and welfare of the tenant, and E would not prohibit that. So I think the restrictions of E are clearly limited to those type of conditions, and that's why it incorporates subchapter B for that definition.
But condition is a broader term than casualty loss under that scheme.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question here.
Condition, as set out in this statutory scheme, is a broader term than casualty loss.
Certainly.
Because of what you just said about
certainly.
The paint deal.
But it includes a casualty loss,
yes.
And that's the facts of our case. And that's why we focus upon that particular provision. I ask the court to look at this reimbursement clause in question. This is not an accurate representation of the reimbursement clause in question. If you dig out that reimbursement clause, I'm out of time.
You are, unless somebody asks you.
Why don't you go ahead
and finish that? I'd like you to finish that, yeah.
If you look at that reimbursement clause, get out your magnifying glasses, because you're gonna, it's going to take one to read it. It's buried in the contract. What is emphasized in the reimbursement clause is what is, in effect, the 92006F provisions, which have to do with wastewater stoppages. Any normal, ordinary human being that would read that would read it as limiting their damages to that.
But the text is accurate.
The text is accurate.
The emphasis is different.
The emphasis is different, and it's not conspicuous. It's not boldly printed. It's hidden, and it's just the type of language and clause that the fair notice doctrine provisions in the common law, R, N, E, are intended to protect a non-negligent tenant like Mrs. Brown in this case.
Any other questions?
I thank the court.
Does a tenant have an insurable interest in apartment dwellings beyond its own? Could they get insurance for an entire apartment complex?
I think that they can get insurance, Your Honor, for any act and consequential damage for their negligence that occurs in their apartment unit. And there are regularly tenant, it's a burgeoning industry in the landlord-tenant field, is tenant insurance for acts of negligence that occur on the property. And I think it would be a consequential damage if the smoking materials, as in this case of Mr. Brown, caused the damage to the rest of the units in the building, his insurance carrier would cover it. And yes, they do have, a tenant does have an insurable interest.
But they wouldn't insure based on a contract reimbursement provision in those policies.
I don't know if they would or not, Your Honor. There are some very creative carriers out there. I don't know whether they would not insure for that.
Just to help me understand, for that kind of a policy, then am I going to have to insure to the value of the entirety of the complex? Because I'm still going to have a limit on the amount of my insurance. So, I mean, if I get a $50,000 policy or a $100,000 policy, and I'm living in a $10 million apartment building, obviously, the $100,000 policy, even if it goes towards consequential
complex.
I think that they can get insurance, Your Honor, for any act and consequential damage for their negligence that occurs in their apartment unit. And there are regularly tenant, it's a burgeoning industry in the landlord-tenant field, is tenant insurance for acts of negligence that occur on the property. And I think it would be a consequential damage if the smoking materials, as in this case of Mr. Brown, caused the damage to the rest of the units in the building, his insurance carrier would cover it. And yes, they do have, a tenant does have an insurable interest.
But they wouldn't insure based on a contract reimbursement provision in those policies.
I don't know if they would or not, Your Honor. There are some very creative carriers out there. I don't know whether they would not insure for that.
Just to help me understand, for that kind of a policy, then am I going to have to insure to the value of the entirety of the complex? Because I'm still going to have a limit on the amount of my insurance. So, I mean, if I get a $50,000 policy or a $100,000 policy, and I'm living in a $10 million apartment building, obviously, the $100,000 policy, even if it goes towards consequential damages, isn't going to help me a whole lot if someone's going to come and say, you've got to pay for the whole $10 million.
I would agree with you that it's going to be insured to the limit of whatever policy you purchase.
Mr. Fritsch, have you looked at the legislative history for this?
I have not. I've conferred with counsel for the Texas Apartment Association, Mr. Neiman, and Mr. Neiman has, I think, sat and listened and tried to find some legislative history, and he's informed me that there really is none.
Well, respond to Mr. Pierce's argument that despite E being denominated an exception to C, E stands on its own as a statement by the legislature that it is going to prohibit landlords from contracting with tenants and co-tenants to reimburse them for damages caused by the tenant.
Your Honor, I would submit that it does not. because C refers to the duty. 92052 refers to the duty of the landlord. B specifically says the landlord does not have a duty.
But he says E is not limited to the landlord's duty. E is limited to simply a condition.
Well, he's saying that it's a shift in loss, or he's attempting to, what the statute does, it shifts the burden of loss, but it cannot. The only way you get to E is through C, and you get...
But then put in your analysis as you're talking about this, his position that the condition, material, which means materially affecting physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant, if you look at subchapter B, you're going to find in there conditions caused by the tenant, conditions caused by the landlord, normal wear and tear, not really caused by anybody, acts of God, and whatever. That condition is not attributable to one person's conduct or to one person's duty.
The waiver provision in E is not going to apply when the condition in subchapter B, 92052, is caused by the tenant or a lawful occupant in the tenant's dwelling or a member of the tenant's family. And again, 92052B refers to, again, the duty of a landlord to repair, not the remedy or the right of the landlord to obtain reimbursement.
But I guess I'm not connecting. I'm really trying very hard to understand your argument. Maybe I'm not quite there yet. When I read E, what I read is they may agree for the tenant to repair or remedy at the tenant's expense any condition covered by subchapter B. I mean, I don't see any discussion of duty or anything else. I see a very broad term there intended, and I'm not making the connection with how duty fits there. I really would like to understand. Will you try one more time for me since I'm being rather dense? I apologize.
Your Honor, I don't think you're being dense. It's very confusing to the third court also. And what's happening here is the third court was reading E as a revision to C. The only way that E is applicable to a condition in subchapter B is as a waiver. And it is a waiver of a landlord's duty in 92.006C. A landlord's duty and the tenant's remedies under subchapter B, which covers conditions materially affecting the physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant.
But that, may I interject, under 052B, the landlord does not have a duty if it's caused by the landlord's thing. So how can, in your scenario, the way you're explaining it, you have to go to E through C when there's no duty on the landlord when those facts exist? And why doesn't it then stand alone as the opposing counsel?
May I give you an example, Your Honor? A tenant resides below another tenant. Someone drops a weight through the floor. There are insects or something coming through the holes. There's a condition that materially affects the health or safety of an ordinary tenant. That tenant down below has the right to give the landlord the notice, as long as they pay their rent, and say that this condition materially affects the health or safety of the ordinary tenant.
But that tenant's a different one than the one we're talking about in this case.
It is.
Because the rights of the landlord against the lower tenant don't implicate the issue we have in this case, so I don't see how your example fits.
Well, in this particular case, 92.006E, which is what the third court turned on, specifically, it cannot apply because the tenant is the person who caused the damage. 92052B of subchapter B specifically only refers to the landlord's duty when it's caused by the tenant. This waiver in 006 refers to those landlord's duties, not the landlord's remedy to go back against the tenant.
But that's my question. If B refers to certain conditions that the landlord is not responsible to pay for or to fix, and those are conditions that materially affect the physical health or safety of the ordinary tenant, right?
Right.
Okay. Explain to me why, if you have an enforceable provision in a lease under subpart E of 92.006, it then doesn't make give the landlord the remedy under B to make the tenant pay.
Because the only way E acts as a waiver is if that landlord owns one unit.
Well, I understand, but let's presume the landlord owns one unit, okay? And E applies because my scenario was that you have an enforceable 92.006 provision in a lease. Doesn't that provision then create under B of 92.052 the right on the right in the landlord to require the tenant to pay for those kinds of things?
That is correct.
Okay. So in fact, E is more than just a waiver provision tied to C. When it is enacted, it also affects other conditions, because earlier on you were saying, well, look what B does, there's no duty, but it doesn't make the tenant pay. E, if an enforceable agreement is entered underneath it, can then give the landlord the right to make the tenant pay for the conditions reflected in B.
Again, it's the duty to repair versus the right of reimbursement.
No, I understand that, but your answer to my question is yes, that if you have an enforceable provision under E, it can then create a right in the landlord to force the tenant to pay under B that otherwise does not exist.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument, and the second call can take it under.
All rise.